Well, we finished up Ruth chapter 2 last week, and we're going to study chapter 3 this week. But before we do, I'd like to review a little bit, kind of get our bearings, because we are about to enter into the second great theological principle demonstrated by the book of Ruth, the principle of the role of the kinsman redeemer in God's plan of redemption for the world. Now, we'll, of course, read the entire third chapter of Ruth. But in a nutshell, it begins with Naomi instructing her daughter-in-law, Ruth, to visit Boaz and attempt to get him to marry her on the grounds that Boaz is her redeemer. Now, Ruth did as Naomi instructed, and Boaz responded as the two widows had hoped. But Boaz also told Ruth that there was another family, Goel, another redeemer, and they lived in Bethlehem. And this redeemer was a nearer relative to Elimelech, all right, than he was, than Boaz was. And that it was proper protocol to give that nearer relative the first chance at performing the duties of a goel. So Boaz gave Ruth all the grain she could ever hope to carry as a sort of a gift, sealing the agreement, sent her home to Naomi to await the outcome of Boaz's meeting with this nearer relative. Now, this sounds pretty straightforward on the surface, but underneath it all, in order for us to really understand the advice that Naomi had given to Ruth and that Ruth faithfully carried out, and to get both the historical and the theological aspects of this event in proper perspective, we have to grasp the very real legal ramifications, at least legal from the Jewish cultural perspective, that were in play and in the process of being satisfied. So hang in there with me as I give you some foundation for studying the final two chapters of the book of Ruth. In Jewish thought of that day, and in fact a thought that was completely in harmony with the scriptures, Yehovah was the true and ultimate owner of the land where the Hebrew people had settled, the former land of Canaan. Now, by means of his covenant with Abraham, the Lord had given Israel the right to inherit this land. However, this inheritance did not involve a transference of ownership, first from the Canaanites to Yehovah, and then from Yehovah to the Israelites. Rather, it was that Israel would only benefit from the use of the land that continued to belong to God. He did not turn over ownership of the land to Israel. The use of the land had been divided up under the supervision of Joshua and Moses among the tribes and among the clans who formed the Israelite tribes. So it's important when we look at a map of Canaan after the conquest, what we could loosely term Israel. And when we do, we see that the 12 tribal territories outlined within their boundaries, and that a further subdivision of the land had also occurred, in which the clans within each tribe were assigned specific portions of land given to their particular tribe. A clan, of course, being just a subdivision of a tribe, a family being a subdivision of a clan. So whoever possessed a certain tract of land was not allowed to sell it or part with it in any other manner. Rather, it was intended that the family land was to remain part of the family, clan, and tribe forever. Again, not as land owners, but rather as the authorized land tenants, if you would, who lived on God's land. Now, should the Hebrew possessor of a piece of the promised land find himself in a situation where he had to sell it, usually on account of some financial disaster, and actually did sell it, then it was the obligation of the nearest family relative to intercede. And so that nearest family relative was to purchase that land back, was to redeem it in order for it to stay in the family and ultimately in the clan. Now we find from the book of Leviticus that even if the land was not redeemed in a timely manner by the family Goel, for whatever the reason could be, that it still eventually came back to the original family by means of the laws of Jubilee. So the laws of Jubilee made it such that land that was lost for a time came back to the original family and clan who had possessed it but lost it. The Jubilee laws required that no payment had to be made to the person who had purchased that land, provided the family waited to reclaim it until the year of Jubilee that came around on a 50-year cycle. So essentially, the land had been lost from the family just temporarily. And further, it wasn't so much that the land itself had been lost as merely the use of the land had been transferred to the new owner, but just for a time. This reality was reflected in the price that a new owner might pay for the land and the price that a redeemer of the land would pay if he interceded and purchased it back after the land had been lost to this new owner. And that price was based not on the value of the land per se, rather on the value of the yearly produce that came from the land. So no actual sale of land had actually ever occurred, at least not as we think of buying and selling real property. Only the use of the land was purchased, and even then, it was just for a time. That's the way it worked. Now, there was another custom of that era that had actually been written into the law of Moses. And that custom is something that we have come to call it levirate marriage. This was the marriage of a brother-in-law to the widowed wife of his brother. And the idea was that a Hebrew man who died without children, or more importantly, without a son, died without an heir. Thus, it was the duty of the deceased man's brother to marry his sister-in-law, who's now widowed, and produce a son with her. This son would not be considered the son of a new husband or of that brother-in-law, but rather as the son of the deceased man. So the deceased man's name and family line would now not come to an end within that clan. The son produced from this levirate marriage then also became the legal heir to the land that belonged to what was biologically his deceased uncle. Now, scripturally and legally speaking, levirate marriage and the obligations of a family redeemer, a goel in Hebrew, are not connected. Two different things. However, in the story of Ruth, we see that the two institutions had at some point become bound together by Hebrew tradition. In other words, while the Torah technically only required that a brother-in-law marry the childless widow of his deceased brother in order to produce an heir, at some point it became customary to include that kind of a marriage obligation as one of the several duties of a goel, if circumstances demanded it. So if the deceased man had no brother, or if there was a brother but he refused to go through with a levirate marriage with the widow, the family goel should step in and accept this role along with the duty to redeem the land of the deceased in order that it stays within the family and the clan. That's how important family, clan, and land were, and how closely organically interconnected they were. So in this section of Ruth that we're about to read, Elimelech had possessed some portion of land in and around the city of Bethlehem. But because both of Elimelech's sons had died, and their widows had produced no sons, there was no legal heir to inherit that land. So the land fell to Elimelech's wife, the widow Naomi. Now, since she was poverty-stricken, she had to sell the land. She was too old to work the land herself. And Boaz, who was related in some way that we don't know to Elimelech, was the family redeemer. He was the goel, whom Naomi hoped would accept the obligations attendant with being the family goel. Now remember, we discussed last week that there's this whole list of duties assigned to a goel. And part of Naomi's hope was that Boaz would marry her daughter-in-law Ruth to give her a well-secured life, plus that Boaz would purchase this field that Naomi had inherited, plus Boaz would give Ruth a son to carry on Mahlon's family name. Remember, Mahlon was Ruth's deceased husband. A little bit complicated. This son would also then be the needed heir for what would amount to his grandfather, Elimelech, and so the clan and family line would be preserved. Like I say, pretty complex. But it only seems that way to us, because this is not at all how Western society operates. So it seems very foreign, if not in some ways downright immoral to us. But this procedure was well understood by the ancient Hebrews. Everybody knew their role. They knew their rights. They knew their duties in this process. Bottom line, if Boaz, a potential family goel, would commit to marry Ruth, a whole series of problems and legal issues would be solved in one bold stroke. So it's with this in mind that we now have our context for reading Ruth chapter 3. And we have a better understanding of Naomi's motives for instructing Ruth in these rather strange, bold actions that Naomi wanted Ruth to take. So open your Bibles to the book of Ruth, chapter 3. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's on page 1059. The book of Ruth, chapter 3. Naomi, whom her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, I should be seeking security for you so that things will go well with you. Now, there's Boaz, our relative. You were with his girls. He's going to be winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So bathe, anoint yourself, put on your good clothes, go down to the threshing floor. But don't reveal your presence to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. Then, when he lies down, take note of where he's lying. Later, go in, uncover his feet, and lie down. He'll tell you what to do." And she responded, "I'll do everything you tell me." So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything as her mother-in-law had instructed her. And after Boaz was through eating and drinking, he was feeling good, he went to lie down at the end of a pile of grain. She stole in, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, the man was startled, and he turned over, and there was a woman lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I'm your handmaid, Ruth. Spread your robe over your handmaid, because you are a redeeming kinsman." He said, "May Adonai bless you, my daughter. Your latest kindness is even greater than your first, in that you didn't go after the young men, neither the rich ones nor the poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you everything you say, for all the city leaders among my people know you are a woman of good character. Now, it is true, I am a redeeming kinsman, but there is a redeemer who is a closer relative than I am. Stay tonight. If in the morning he will redeem you, fine. Let him redeem you. But if he doesn't want to redeem you, then as Adonai lives, I will redeem you. Now lie down until morning." Well, she lay at his feet until morning, and then before it was light enough that people could recognize each other, she got up. Because he said no one should know that the woman came to the threshing floor. He also said, "Bring the shawl you are wearing and take hold of it." And she held it while he put 6 measures of barley into it, and then he went into the city. When she came to her mother-in-law, she asked, "Who are you, my daughter?" She told her everything the man had done for her. Then she added, "He gave me the 6 measures of barley because he said to me, 'You should not return to your mother-in-law with nothing.'" Naomi said, "My daughter, just stay where you are until you learn how the matter comes out, for the man won't rest until he resolves this matter today." Well, some unrecorded amount of time passes between the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3, probably just a short time, because we find that the threshing part of the harvesting process was still ongoing. Now, Naomi has had a chance to ponder this wonderful turn of fortunes she has suffered in the form of Ruth's providential meeting with Boaz, an elderly but a well-to-do relative of Elimelech. And she has no interest in letting this amazing opportunity pass her by. And after she has formulated a plan, she starts a conversation with Ruth that begins with, "My daughter, shall I not seek rest for you so that it may be well with you?" Or our complete Jewish Bible, I think, has a little better translation where it says, "Shall I not seek security for you?" Now, the Hebrew word that is in most translations rendered as rest is manoach. Manoach. And in this context, manoach means a place of rest. And the place she's referring to is in the home of a new husband who can give Ruth safety and shelter and a very well-secured life that was generally only available to a woman by means of marriage. This bodes back to the first part of our story of Ruth while they were still in Moab. In chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, Naomi had prayed this prayer over her two daughters-in-law, both widows now. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Each of you go back to your mother's house. May Adonai show grace to you as he did to those who died and to me. May Adonai grant you security in the home of a new husband." Then she kissed them, but they began weeping aloud. See, this is a wonderful example, I think, of how God works in concert with his worshipers to bring about his will. It's been a long time since Naomi had prayed for new husbands for her daughters-in-law. You know, one wonders if she even recalled that she had done so. But what a gracious and important lesson it is for us that God hears our prayers and he answers them sometimes even long after perhaps we've forgotten that we've even prayed them. So in this statement, Naomi is telling Ruth that what she is about to instruct has Ruth's welfare as its goal. Naomi tells Ruth in verse 2 that since Boaz is a family goel, that it is her intent to involve him as the solution to their predicament. And to remind us of this, of the context of this multifaceted solution she was seeking. First of all, how could Naomi find a way to keep the family name of her deceased husband, Elimelech, and his clan alive, since he, her husband, and both of his sons, Naomi's two sons, were dead? Second, how could the elderly Naomi properly protect the all-important land inheritance that had been left in her trust, since her husband died and there were no male heirs in the family? Third, how could Ruth, young, so much life yet to live, be afforded a good and a decent future? And although it's not front and center, but it is self-evident. Fourth, how could Naomi find a means of support in her old age, since she has no sons to provide and care for her? The answer to all of these challenges may lie in Boaz if her plan works. Now, one could also ask, how is it that Naomi knew that Boaz would be at the threshing floor that night? In fact, would the farmers really be doing winnowing at dark? The winnowing process was very rudimentary in that day. A threshing floor was little more than a relatively flat area of ground that was in a place where a breeze would flow through. A surface of a rock, well, that was preferable, but more often than not, a threshing floor was just an area where the soil had been tamped down till it was hard. And after the stalks of grain were laid upon it and then pounded to loosen the heads away from their stems, men and women with pitchforks, they would heave the stalks up into the air, and the breeze would carry the lightest part, which was the straw, a distance away, while the heavier part, the kernels of grain would then fall more or less straight down. The problem is that while some wind is required to make this process work right, it had to be the right amount of wind. Too strong of a wind, and the grain blew away right along with the chaff and the straw. Too little wind, and everything that went up in the air came right back down, so it didn't separate. Well, the time of year for the wheat harvest was late to early fall, and it was hot, and the desert winds were always quite strong during that time of the year. But as the sun moved downward towards the horizon, the breeze became gentle. By dark, it became calm. So it wasn't truly nighttime that Naomi was speaking of. Rather, it was dusk when Boaz was out winnowing, and that would have been the regular time, really, that winnowing took place in that part of Judah where they were. So Naomi wasn't a clairvoyant, nor had she been spying. She simply knew how and when winnowing operated in Beit Lechem. Now, since the plan was for Boaz to marry Ruth, wily old Naomi knew the one step one was to make Ruth attractive to Boaz. So she instructs her to bathe, anoint herself, and then put on good clothes. Now, there's a lot of commentary out there on this one verse that wants to paint a picture of a very pious and righteous Ruth taking a ritual bath. In other words, in a mikvah. Anointing herself in oil as a spiritual matter, and then putting on a wedding dress. In fact, that's more or less the standard Christian take on this. But that's just not the case. First, there is no religious ritual occurring here. The immersion is just a common bath meant to cleanse her body, remove the dirt, dust, and sweat. The anointing was not of a religious matter. It was merely the application of scented oil, whose base was olive oil, to make her skin smooth and to apply a pleasing fragrance like a perfume. Finally, the usual rendering, like in our complete Jewish Bibles, of Ruth putting on her good clothes is simply not a warranted translation. It's just a bad translation. And in fact, it goes against just the plain meaning of it. See, rather, Naomi just uses the more or less standard generic word for clothes, simla. Although simla was used as a general word for clothing in that era, it also was the proper name of a kind of garment that is sometimes called a cape or a cloak or a mantle. It was an everyday garment of the common folk that more or less resembled a long blanket. It was worn around the waist, and then one end was thrown over the shoulder, and then they would hang down. In fact, it often doubled as a blanket when someone was sleeping. In no way does this indicate anything but regular, everyday dress. So why would Naomi tell her to put on just regular clothing? After all, Ruth wasn't going to show up naked to meet Boaz. Well, the sages have a pretty good solution for this that makes common sense. See, widows in that era often stayed in mourning for a very long time, sometimes until they were remarried. So the rabbis say that Naomi was telling Ruth it was time to put away her widow's outfit and return to wearing a simla, which was just the everyday clothing. The notion that she would show up to meet Boaz in a wedding dress, well, that just doesn't fly. I mean, it would have been presumptuous beyond imagination to do such a thing. And besides, a couple of poor widows wouldn't have had the luxury of good clothing, let alone a wedding dress, just kind of sitting on a shelf waiting to be used. So who came up with this idea of a wedding dress as the meaning? It was another of those doctrines that comes from working with the New Testament and then going backwards. All right, in other words, since Christianity has long and correctly held that Yeshua is the kinsman redeemer for all who believe, then the image of the saints as the brides of Messiah and his brides coming to the wedding feast of the Lamb, it's then applied in reverse to the Ruth story. So the reasoning is that Ruth must have been putting on a wedding dress since she was about to come into relationship with her kinsman redeemer. Not a chance. And this is a very good example of what happens when one tries to explain the Old Testament in light of the New instead of the other way around. Now Ruth continues her instructions, or rather Naomi continues her instructions to Ruth, telling her to stay out of Boaz's view, but to take very careful notice of where he beds down for the night. Further, since it will be at the end of the day and it's going to be dark, Boaz will have completed his work, then he will have dined, and he will have drank before retiring. And when it speaks of his drinking, it very likely includes wine, because it just wasn't common parlance to break a meal down to the eating of solid food and drinking of liquid if it was just water. Rather, drinking invariably refers to drinking alcoholic beverages, and the context bears all that out as well, by the way. Further, this doesn't in any way mean that he went to bed drunk. It just means that he was well off enough to afford some wine with his meal, something almost any Hebrew would have preferred if they had the money. But then the instructions get a little dicey. Naomi tells Ruth to uncover his feet and lie down with him. Now, I'm sure most of you have an image of seduction in your minds about now. And you might be right, although it was not to the extent, I think, that some have claimed. See, here's the thing. The Bible can get very sensual and sexual at times. Sex was just an everyday part of life. And while modesty was called for, still is called for, in God's people, they were also around farm animals all the time. Every child was familiar from an early age of the natural reproductive processes. And certain flirtations between men and women were open and common in biblical days that today might even be seen as crude and objectionable by many Christians. I'm going to explain where I'm going with this a little later. Naomi's last words were really kind of odd. She says, Boaz will tell you what to do. And to this, Ruth promised she would faithfully do what Naomi instructed. And there's always been a question about this little kabuki dance that Naomi tells Ruth to perform, as to whether this was sort of customary for Hebrews in that day or if it was unique to this story. The answer is, we don't know. For sure, the whole purpose for this endeavor is for Ruth to indicate her desire, without doubt, to marry Boaz. But is this how engagement happened among the ancient Jews? I mean, there's no records to indicate such a thing. And although there are a couple of somewhat similar scenes in the Bible, such as Ezekiel 16 and 2 Samuel 12, they're not quite the same, but on another level. While her going to Boaz, uncovering his feet, and then laying down beside him may not necessarily have been usual. The purpose of proposing marriage on the grounds that Boaz is her goel is likely what Naomi was referring to when she said that Boaz would then tell her what to do. That is, see, Ruth, remember, was a Moabite, a Gentile. She was unfamiliar with the Jewish ways. Even though most Middle Eastern societies, almost certainly the Moabites as well, had some kind of family redeemer customs they followed, how each nation performed them would have been a little bit different. Naomi and Boaz thoroughly understood the roles and duties of a goel within Hebrew society and all the nuances of how someone approached a potential goel for their help. And often there were some unique social intricacies that would follow. Of these, Ruth knew little, if anything. She was a foreigner. So while Naomi got the ball rolling sufficiently for Boaz to understand what was being asked of him, Ruth would then have to rely on Boaz to take over and then do what logically and legally came next. And that depended on whether or not he accepted Ruth's request of him or not. So, as Naomi said, he'll tell you what to do. This whole thing was up to Boaz. Well, it was getting dark. So Ruth left her mother-in-law, went to the threshing floor. She did exactly what Naomi told her to do, fully trusting that Naomi not only knew what she was doing, but that it was honorable and it had Ruth's best interest in mind. Verse 8 says that Boaz had finished eating and drinking and he was feeling good. This is not talking about a general state of well-being. Boaz had a little bit of a buzz on due to downing a couple of glasses of wine. Tired and relaxed, he located himself at the end of the pile of grain that had been winnowed, undoubtedly to make sure no one came to help themselves to the product of his day's work, and he fell asleep there. So Ruth stole in quietly so as not to disturb his sleep, uncovered his feet, and lay down next to him. Sometime later, middle of the night, something awakened Boaz, and he was startled to find a person lying next to him. It was dark. He was drowsy. So he blurts out, "Who's there?" Ruth responds that it is she. And would he spread his robe over her because he is her goel? Boy, there's a lot going on here. So let's kind of take this step by step. Truly, the most controversial aspect of this section is the part of Ruth uncovering his feet. Now, the controversy is that feet is often used as a biblical idiom to refer to the genitals. Covering one's feet is also at times used to describe going to the bathroom. So some scholars, primarily those who specialize in literary criticism techniques, believe that what Ruth did was to expose Boaz's genitals as an expression of her desire for him to marry her. And that maybe this was some heretofore unknown engagement practice in that era. In fact, that whole line of thought has become a rather properly or recent interpretation of this scene. It's hard to find a commentary that doesn't say exactly that. But more level-headed scholars Gentile and Jew make it clear there's just way too many problems associated with that approach to make that what was going on. First of all, let's dispel this new view that Ruth committed a very sexually provocative act upon the slumbering Boaz. The Hebrew word that is usually rendered feet, as we find it in the book of Ruth, is margalot. Margalot. In the entire Bible, that word is used in three places. Here in Ruth, once more in Daniel 10, and every single time it means legs, not feet. You with me? Margalot refers to the larger region of the body than just the feet. In fact, some scholars think it just basically means everything from the hips on down. That is, the legs and the feet together. The entirety of the extremities that starts at the hip. The usual Hebrew word for foot or feet throughout the Old Testament is regel. And indeed, we do find the word regel used in this idiom, Hebrew idiom, that definitely does refer to the genitals. Nowhere in the whole of the Bible, nowhere, do we find the Hebrew word margalot used that way. And thus, it's almost certainly inaccurate to translate margalot to be feet here in Ruth. It should be translated as legs. So as we have Ruth uncovering Boaz's legs, not feet, and her lying there next to him as instructed by her mother-in-law, that's all that's going on. However, there are sexual overtones to all this that's hard to dispute. It's the issue about it is the degree of it all. Certainly, what man would go to bed alone only to be startled awake by a lovely young woman lying next to him, not be a little bit excited about this whole thing? I mean, if you're an older man, like Boaz, and this young thing sneaks into your bed and crawls under your blanket and essentially proposes marriage, well, that's going to get your attention. But it seems that the author of this story intends it to be this way. After all, Ruth is trying to entice Boaz to marry her. And by all accounts, she's quite beautiful. Not only in character, but in appearance. So what could be more normal than for her to make natural use of these gifts in a way that interests men? Let's also dispel this thought, however, of some aggressive sexual action taken by Ruth upon Boaz as he sleeps by recalling the context and history of the entire Ruth narrative. Ruth and Boaz have shown themselves to be exemplary people, devout, faithful to Jehovah, righteous, upright. Boaz has raved about how well known Ruth's high character is among the residents of Beit Lechem. And Boaz has been shown to be a very kind man with the noblest of his motives, intentions, and everything he does. Except within the institution of marriage, for a woman to look upon an exposed man could bring her terrible punishment. I mean, recall the instance in the Torah of a wife who tried to help her husband when he was fighting somebody else by grabbing the genitals of her husband's opponent. It resulted in her hand being cut off. So for Ruth to uncover a man's private parts would have been nothing less than prostitution. To accuse Ruth and Boaz of engaging in sexual activities that are strictly forbidden by the law of Moses would be completely inconsistent with everything we've learned about them, but would also run counter to the entire purpose and nature of this story. There's a lot more we need to dissect about this nocturnal encounter. But let's just stop here for today, and we'll continue in chapter 3 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.